It's Dave Gaharry reporting, reporting from the corner of Wall and Fraud, Bernard. Bernard, if we can thank one individual for leveling the playing field for the individual investor, it would be my guest. Arthur Levitt, the former and longest-serving chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, grew up in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn, became a broker in 1963, and 6 months after Bill Clinton was inaugurated, was appointed to head the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. While SEC Chairman, Arthur Levitt championed the cause of the individual investor, who, as he states in his book, is not represented in Washington, against an entity he had never experienced before. In his own words, the ability of Wall Street and corporate America to combine their considerable forces to stymie reform efforts. There has never been a more effective advocate for the voiceless individual investor in the history of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now Arthur Levitt has brought his regulatory zeal to the bookshelf in Take on the Street, What Wall Street and Corporate America Don't Want You to Know, What You Can Do to Fight Back. Because of Arthur Levitt, our securities markets are infinitely fairer to the individual today, and more importantly, tomorrow. As he states in the dedication of his book, quote, if investors benefit from this undertaking, Matt and Will Friedland and Sydney, Emma, Molly, and Jake Levitt will enjoy the benefits of a fairer and more trustworthy market. Chairman Levitt, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you today.
Let me say first about your book. Wow. I mean, I was, I've been an avid reader of the Wall Street Journal for about 8 years now, 8.5 years. And what your book did for me was just fill in the pieces. I mean, you experienced firsthand what was happening behind the scenes, what reporters were not privy to, and I just want to thank you so much for it. It was wonderful.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Let me ask you this, sir. To start off, what motivated you to start a manuscript? I guess this was your first book project.
Yeah, I guess it was my years in being a broker and running a brokerage firm, then running a stock exchange and getting to the SEC. I saw how disadvantaged the individual investor was, how little they tended to know about some of the traps that were out there set by brokerage firms, by congressmen willing to go along with business pressures, by the accountants, by everybody up and down the line. And I thought I could write something that any investor could understand to help them get involved in a fairer way and protect themselves from what hurt them so badly during this market meltdown.
Right. And of course, all the things that you had warned about and had tried to correct were exactly the reasons for the market meltdown.
Yeah, I mean, investors thought buying a mutual fund was automatic safety, and it wasn't. And investors thought that if they listened to their broker unquestioningly, they'd be fine. I tell them basically to fire their broker.
Right. That was great. Now, let me back up a bit. I forgot to mention this. Your dad was six times elected New York State Comptroller as a Democrat.
Yep.
Yeah. He says here for 24 years he was the sole custodian of the multi-billion-dollar pension fund of thousands of New York public employees. And as you explained in the book, he took his job very seriously. I guess that's where you get a lot of your attention to the individual.
Yeah, that's true. I saw him guard those funds as jealously as if they were his own. And I saw my mother, who was a school teacher for 38 years, just obsessed about her pension and what it meant to her and how she could protect it and what her options were. So I grew up with a sense of what the average person needs to know and what the average person's vulnerabilities are in terms of investing in our markets.
Right, and you came, I guess, kind of late to the industry. You were about 32.
Yeah, that's right.
And one of your first partners, I think, was Sandy Weil. Is that correct?
That's right. For nearly 13 years, Sandy and I were partners.
And he now, of course, is the chairman and CEO of Citigroup.
Yep.
Which he wrested control of from John Reed, who was the chairman and CEO of Citicorp when they merged. Then you were the chairman of the Amex, the American Stock Exchange.
That's right.
From what was that? From 1978 to 89, or?
Yes, it was 78 to 89.
Mm-hmm.
It was a an exchange for high growth, medium sized companies that challenged NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange, and we tried to give them a greater voice for investors.
Right, and now, of course, the Amex is owned by the NASDAQ, isn't that correct? Yeah. Now, the American Stock Exchange was known informally as the Curb Exchange, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, and simply because they would stand out there by the curb? Or?
Yep.
Yeah. Bernard, you you worked as a broker, didn't
well,
you?
I worked in the trade department at Bation, what was Bation Company then, purchase and sales department. We would match all the sales on both the American and the New York Stock Exchange, kind of balance out everything at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but yeah, there was a curve, there was over-the-counter stocks as well as the big board.
Right. That's Bernard White, by the way, Chairman Levitt.
Hi, Bernard.
Hi there.
Now, when Bill Clinton appointed you to head the Securities Exchange Commission, you say here on page 10, when I came to Washington, I had a pretty clear understanding of how the main power centers worked. Once I began pursuing my agenda, however, I saw a dynamic I hadn't fully witnessed before. The ability of Wall Street and corporate America to combine their considerable forces to stymie reform efforts. It seems like, from reading your book, Chairman Levitt, that most of your time was spent, I think you even said that, most of your time was spent dealing with the lobbying efforts of the industry against any reform efforts that would benefit the individual investor.
That's really so. I probably spend a good third of my time on Capitol Hill responding to members of Congress who had received large campaign contributions from corporate America and the brokerage firms and the banks. And they tried to frustrate almost every investor initiative we came up with.
Right.
They called me to hearings. They asked us to delay these initiatives. They tried to water them down, almost anything to stifle reform. And while these lobbyists for the exchanges and the brokerage firms and the corporations were up there, nobody, absolutely nobody, was up there representing individuals.
Right. Not one group, because they're not organized.
That's right. Right. And I've suggested that through regular organizations like AARP and the AFL and mm-hmm. the Consumer Federation of America, they can be organized and they can have a voice, and that would make a difference in terms of their investment results.
Right, absolutely. And I think one of the first steps any individual investor should take, if they're serious about their money, which they should be, is to pick up a copy of this book, Take on the Street, by you, Arthur Levitt. It really is, and I'm not just saying that because you're on the phone and you're a hero of mine, which you are, because of everything you've done for the individual investor. You were the only representative of the individual investor. I'm saying that because it's a great book, and it points out step by step what individuals should do to become smarter in the marketplace. And, you know, I always wondered, because when I read your farewell address from, I think that was your last town hall meeting.
Yes, in Philadelphia.
Right. It reminded me eerily, because it was almost 40 years to the day of Eisenhower's farewell address. It reminded me eerily of that address, where Eisenhower warned of the military-industrial complex, and he said, your only weapon is to educate yourself against it. Did you take any cues from that?
No, I'm flattered by the comparison, but having been a broker tends to give you a perspective on the needs of investors and the anxieties of investors, and I held 43 town meetings while I was in the job around the country, and I saw the passion of individual investors. I saw how fearful they were of asking tough questions. They tended to trust their brokers and their advisors, and they just didn't want to ask what they thought were dumb questions. And I try to point out in the book that there is no such thing as a dumb question.
Right. I think you definitely did do that. But you know what I think the problem is, and you point that out on page 43 when you had decided to bring the staff in on finding out exactly how much or how little individual investors understood about mutual funds. And you say here that you hired this is the SEC's Division of Investment Management, which oversaw the mutual fund industry, told you in 1993 that they had no idea how much investors really understood about mutual funds. And of course, 93 was when you came in. You came in the summer of 93, is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah. And you said, so we hired a polling firm to find out after several surveys and even a few focus groups, efforts that the Investment Company Institute, the industry's trade group, derided as pseudoscientific, we realized that most investors were even more befuddled than we had imagined. Now, this is where it all stems from. People really know so little about the structure of the stock exchanges and the stock markets and the whole system. So I think that's where individual investors really get into trouble, because they know so little about it, they're afraid, like you said, to ask the questions.
You're absolutely right. That's just how it happens.
Yeah, and your chapter, by the way, about the plumbing, pay attention to the plumbing, was great.
I loved it.
I just hope that people really take this opportunity to go out and get this book and spend some time reading it. Somebody such as myself, who pays attention to the markets and is a student of the market, can read the book and enjoy it right off the bat. But someone who doesn't might have to read it, a few times, and that's okay. Don't be afraid about reading it a few times, because it's going to take a few times to sink in. Because if you're not living with this stuff every day, then you have no choice really but to do that.
I tried to make it written in a way that my Aunt Edna would have understood it.
Did you have an Aunt Edna?
I did have an Aunt Edna, and she was bright, but she certainly had no experience in the market.
Right.
And I wanted this to be written not for someone who runs a large company, but for the typical average investor with a 401k or just a small mutual fund.
Right. Right.
Bernard, what were some of the major reforms that you tried to get through, and what was the opposition?
Well, probably the one that was fought the most strenuously was the reform of the accounting industry, where I felt that the accountants had many conflicts between auditing firms and consulting for them. And when I tried to get them to split off consulting from their auditing activities, it was a buzzsaw of congressional opposition. And I put some letters in the back of the book from corporate heads and from congressmen trying to stifle the SEC. And one letter was interesting. It was from a head of a company that said, in effect, Mr. Leavitt, we depend on Arthur Andersen. They're vitally important to us, and we wish you wouldn't force them to give up consulting. It's so helpful to us. And it was signed Kenneth Lay.
Yeah, I read that one. That was a good one. Of course, Ken Lay was the chairman and CEO of Enron, right? Yeah. And he's still roaming free.
Yeah.
Yeah, somehow. Yeah, these letters are wonderful. For the first letter, you got that 15-pager where it says, in a classic example of how industry groups work the legislative process, the 16 questions to which the authors demand answers within 2 weeks were meant as a shot across the SEC's bow and a warning that the agency could expect more of the same treatment if it went ahead with the new rules. Bernard, it was unbelievable how Chairman Leavitt points out how these congressmen, and I think there were, I don't think you mentioned any women, although there were some signatories who were women, but these congressmen, like Billy Towson from Louisiana, and Tom Bliley, he's no longer in Congress, is that right?
From Virginia.
No, retired back to Richmond.
Good. These guys really just, even Graham, and I wanted to ask you, but did Graham actually put his finger in your chest, or were you just being figurative with that?
No, he was a good friend of mine, even though we didn't agree on anything.
Right.
And we had some real debates, but they were always on a very professional level.
Okay, so he really didn't poke his finger in your chest?
No.
Okay, all right. Because it seems like there was a lot of heated debating between you and these people who would demand to see you, and really, it seems like to me that, and I had this opinion before, that for the most part, the quote-unquote public servants in Washington are pretty much there to do the bidding of the corporations.
I think that's true, and I certainly experienced that.
Mm. And that's a shame.
What about the issue of money laundering? Does much of that go on in Wall Street?
I don't think that's a very general practice in Wall Street. We didn't come across much of that. There was lots of insider trading and a great deal of trouble with the analysts who were not telling it as it was, because the corporate clients of the brokerage firms would have left the firms if the analysts wrote negative reports about them. But money laundering is not something that we saw much of.
I think there was, oh, sorry, I was just going to say there was one specific case, that with the Bank of New York, I believe.
Yeah.
How do you stop insider trading?
You stop it by bringing cases against those traders, sending them to jail, which we have to do with the Justice Department because the commission has no criminal authority. But we brought more cases against insider trading during my years at the commission than ever before, because more insider trading was going on.
Right. You have in one of your chapters called The Seven Deadly Sins of Mutual Funds, because, Bernard, we've talked about mutual funds before, and I explained how I'm really not a big fan of them, except for the index funds. I'm a big fan of John Bogle, and of your cell phone, I guess, or somebody's cell phone. sorry about that. You say here in one of the deadly sins is called the culture of performance, and I love this line you have here. It says, it's like looking in the rearview mirror to see the road ahead.
That's so true.
That's perfect.
That's all you see these funds advertise, is performance, what they did last year. They don't tell you how they did it. And certainly what they did is absolutely no indication of what might happen in the future.
Right, right, exactly. And of course, they stuffed these funds, their performance, with IPOs that we weren't made aware of.
You're right on.
Right, the Van Kampen case, I think, was the one that you mentioned in the book. Let me ask you this. With what's going on today, there's a story in the Journal about securities firms agreeing to pay for failing to retain emails. And this was while you were head of the SEC. You said, I believe, as early as 1997, that emails should be kept, and issued a clarification of the rules in November 2001. Of course, you left in February 2001. These firms, these five securities firms, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Salomon Smith Barney, which is a part of Citigroup, U.S. Bank Corp, Piper Jaffray, a unit of U.S. Bank Corp, and the securities unit of Deutsche Bank, they just didn't hold on to these emails, and they're going to pay a fine, supposedly, for about $8.3 million, which is $1.65 million each. But the point is, does it seem like they figured, hey, you know what? We're just not going to produce these emails, and we'll pay $8.3 million in order to save perhaps billions of dollars. Do you think that's the case?
I'm not sure what their calculation was, but clearly, with all the publicity being given to emails as something that is the primary tool of investigators and prosecutors, firms simply have not been as scrupulously about holding on to those emails as they should have been. And I think they'll do anything they can to avoid that.
Right, but it seems like they, I don't know, just, you know, from...
I don't disagree with you. That's not an enormous penalty for a firm to pay.
No, which is, you know, which is what a lot of individual investors that I'm in contact with, that's one of their main gripes. They think that this is the cost of doing business, that these firms will surely fork over a couple of million or even $100 million, like the Merrill fine that Spitzer retrieved equated to 1.9 to 2.6% of the money that was misappropriated from the seven internet stocks that Spitzer studied. So if that's the cost of doing business, well, why wouldn't they do it over and over again? And what a lot of them also want to understand, which they can't seem to understand, is it seems like these firms always neither admit nor deny wrongdoing.
Yeah, the problem is that prosecutors' resources are so stretched that the threat of firms to take these cases to court and tying up personnel for an extended period of time for an uncertain result before a jury is something that motivates the regulators very often to settle for less than I think most people would feel would be fair and appropriate.
Right, so your hands are tied.
Yeah.
And of course, Congress has everything to do with that, and you do have in the book, and I'm not going to go through the names because I expect people should pick up the book, and if they're serious, like I said, about their money, and they should be, and take a look at these names. But there are some congressmen who are on your, as you called it, your honor roll, and there are some who are less than honorable. And I think that people should be aware of these names. But I do want to mention one name because we are in New York. Charles Schumer is someone who fought reform efforts, didn't he?
Schumer is an interesting case because he did fight accounting reform. On the other hand, he did protect investors in terms of other initiatives. So I would neither put him on the... I would not put him on the list of those that were against investors, but he does represent most of the brokerage firms in this state, and that tends to focus him on their interests. But I think that he's a pretty intelligent senator, and you could reason with him,
right,
although we disagreed quite a bit on the issue of the accountants.
Do you think that the main reason that these who might appear to be sensible public servants, the main reason that they are fighting reform is because of campaign contributions?
Absolutely. Absolutely, without a question.
That's not good. If we could just look at the current day, where it seems like New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer has assumed the role in the minds of many of the Securities and Exchange Commission. What are your views about Spitzer right now?
I think Spitzer is very creative, very ambitious, and he's used a law that's peculiar to the state of New York called the Martin Act,
right,
to investigate the area of analyst conflicts, and I think that's constructive. I would hope that state regulators are able to coordinate their efforts with the SEC, because if you have all of these regulators going at firms on their own, it will be very difficult to get settlements, and it will create a kind of confusion and redundancy which ultimately will hurt investors.
Right. So this 1921 Martin Act, if that didn't exist on the books in New York, then none of this could have happened.
That's true. And I think if we didn't have an attorney general who was on top of things and working fairly creatively, it wouldn't have happened.
Right, right. And of course, there's a meeting today in New York between state securities regulators, the SEC, and the New York Stock. They say the New York Stock Exchanges, but of course, I guess they mean the Amex and the NYSE,
yeah,
to help determine the exact penalties that will be presented in settlement talks with the companies. I guess the NASDAQ, which isn't a stock exchange, it's a stock market, I guess they're not involved in it. They already had their fun, right?
That's for sure.
Yeah, and you pointed that out. You know, I don't know if you saw a couple of articles recently. Of course, the one in Barron's by Tom Donlin.
I did.
Okay, you saw that then. Did you happen to see the one, you were out of the country at the time, November 4th by Mike Rappaport?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, called Point of View. Here's who should replace Harvey Pitt?
No.
Okay.
No.
Tell me what you think about this. He's saying,
where did it appear?
It was in the Wall Street Journal online, Dow Jones, Newswire's column. Well, anyway, without going into the whole piece, he says, here's a suggestion. Pitt's successor, this is, of course, prior to Harvey Pitt, the current SU chairman, resigning. He said Pitt's successor should be none other than his predecessor, Arthur Levitt, who chaired the SEC from 1993 to 2001. And his reason is because if Bush wants individual investors to get back into the market and have some trust and faith, then they would have to put somebody like you in there. Are you willing to come back if you're asked?
No, I don't think it would be good for me or good for the country, actually. Our system is so great at taking people from the private sector, bringing them into government with new, fresh ideas, and then phasing them out and bringing someone else in. And I think that's the way it should be.
So you have no interest in
no. In
coming back. Do you have any ideas about who you might like to see at the helm?
No, I think there are lots of people who could do the job and do it well.
But you don't have anybody in mind?
No. Okay. And I think it probably wouldn't be appropriate for me to make any suggestions of that kind.
Okay. I have a couple of questions for you from some individual investors, if you wouldn't
sure.
mind taking them. Okay. First one is there are certain individuals / privately held corporations that would like to assist the SEC in uncovering securities fraud. Since the SEC is obviously understaffed, is there a way that the private sector, on a fee basis, can help in the disclosure process? Background checks of directors, officers, promoters, analysis of promotional releases, analysis of message board content, review of financial statements for inconsistencies, etc. A private investigative company that would cater only to the securities industry?
You know, the best way that individual investors have helped the SEC is by tipping them to bad practices. I would say about a third of our enforcement cases come from leads given us by the public. The notion of taking on people from the general public to assist the SEC is an interesting one, and I've toyed with it while I was there, but the rules for government service are so complex that becomes a very difficult problem to administer.
Right. I understand. I have another one from Tom O'Keefe, who's the president of the National Association of Investment Professionals. He quotes from bottom of page 15 in your book, where you say, America's markets operate by a set of rules that are half written and half custom. That makes the individual's responsibility to discern hidden motivations and conflicts of interest as important as any law or regulation. And his question is, even if an investor reads all of a company's financial statements and understands them, how can that investor trust these statements, since companies like Enron and WorldCom play by their own rules or no rules at all? And isn't it really the job of the regulators to determine the hidden motivations and conflicts of interest, since many investors don't even know what to look for?
Yeah, I'd say it is the job of the regulator, but no regulator was ever devised that could totally assure investors against fraud and deception. The way the U.S. system works, and works well, I think, is a combination of the enforcement efforts of the SEC, the enforcement efforts of the stock exchanges, and private rights of action, the ability of individuals to bring suit when appropriate. So I guess I come out with the feeling that a dollar spent on educating investors probably has greater velocity and impact than a dollar spent on a new rule. There's just no way that you could have enough rules to let investors go blindly ahead and do anything they want and be assured that they weren't going to be ripped off.
Right.
Investors are perhaps the most important part of the equation, and all of us have got to spend much more effort in educating them.
Right, exactly, which your book does. The last question is, and a lot of individual investors quite do not understand this. They want you to explain what self-regulation is, which many of them consider ridiculous, and how it works. They see, for example, the NASDAQ paying that over $1 billion fine for keeping the spreads artificially wide, as you explained in your book, the Christie and Schultz study. They see the New York Stock Exchange, as you talk about in your book, the 1998 floor broker scandal, where the front running and so on and so forth had happened. And they see the New York Stock Exchange that completely suspended oversight of their floor for a period of over 2 years, which led to the June 29th, 1999 censure by you of the New York Stock Exchange. Why should we continue to have self-regulation? Why should we trust what many individual investors consider to be the fox guarding the hen house?
Largely because there simply aren't resources sufficient to assure investors that they can be comprehensively protected. While self-regulation isn't perfect, it does work well in tandem with the kind of oversight the SEC gives to it. The New York Stock Exchange probably has tighter, more comprehensive rules and regulations today than any time in its history. Mm-hmm. And while occasionally they may slip, they are under the guidance and direction and oversight of the SEC.
Right.
We didn't hesitate to bring charges against them. We didn't hesitate to bring charges against the NASDAQ marketplace. And it's that threat which keeps them doing a fairly good job for investors. So that my answer to that question is the SEC can't do it alone. Self-regulation isn't perfect, but it works darn well together with the SEC. And I've seen markets in other parts of the world, and there is no other market that can compare to ours.
Well, thanks to you, Chairman Leavitt, and I want to thank you so much for your 7.5 years on the job as SEC Chairman. What you did for the individual investor was incredible. I urge people to go out now or go online, take on the street, what Wall Street and corporate America don't want you to know, what you can do to fight back, by Arthur Leavitt, the former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Sir, I'm sorry we got off to a late start. I hope we can have you back again.
Sure, I'd enjoy that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You have a great day.
You too.
Okay.